Welcome to the Dairobi Health Show. Before we get started, there's some resources available to you that I want to share. First of all, make sure and go to Dairobi.com and check the resources page. There you'll find our free Nutrition and Fitness for Busy Professionals mini course, which is highly recommended, absolutely free, as well as the current year's Dirty Dozen printable PDF sheet, which shows you those dozen foods you really ought to buy organic, along with the Clean 15, those 15 foods that you're probably wasting your money on if you buy them organic. In addition, you will find the Dairobi Undiet PDF. And that is designed to give you 7 very simple to follow strategies of health, nutrition, and fitness. Basically, the Dairobi Undiet is designed for people who just want to look like a statue of a Greek god or goddess and do it in a very simple way. And one last thing, if you see something on Dairobi.com that you like, make sure and use the coupon code INSIDER to save 15%. So at checkout, enter the code INSIDER, INSIDER, and get 15% off anything your heart desires. And now, on with the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Dairobi Health Show. Today, I have Mindy Gorman-Plutzer, who brings 25 years of nutritional counseling experience to her private practice as a certified functional nutrition and lifestyle practitioner. She's also a board-certified integrative health coach and certified eating psychology coach. She introduces a unique functional approach to simple and complex health issues relating to or resulting from disordered and addictive eating behaviors. She's the author of The Freedom Promise, 7 Steps to Stop Fearing What Food Will Do to You and Start Embracing What It Can Do for You, and recently launched her online program, Stop Fearing Food and Start Loving Your Body, an unconventional approach to say goodbye to your disordered eating for good. She's appeared on SiriusXM's Doctor Radio, Huffington Post Live, ABCNews.com podcast, various syndicated radio shows and podcasts, and written for Mind Body Green. She blogs regularly on these subjects and is an expert, and I'm excited to have her on the show. Mindy, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm really thrilled to be here.
I'm thrilled to have you here. We spent just a few minutes chatting before we started recording, and the more I talked to you, the more intrigued and fascinated I got. I think it's such an important subject, and we're going to hit on several different things here. But you have a very interesting past. You have a very interesting experience and focus and the books that you've written. What brought you to this point and to have an interest in these subjects?
It was my own personal experience with recovery. That's the bottom line. I spent more years than I can count, more years than I care to count, of my adult life worrying about what food would do to me. I could say that my recovery from 20 plus years of disordered eating behaviors and disordered thinking, really, because that's a very big part of it, was like every other conventional protocol. I had weekly weigh-ins at the doctor's office, twice weekly therapy sessions, and meetings with a dietitian. So I was essentially being told what to weigh, what to think, and what to eat. I was basically doing recovery, but until my unique biology was addressed, I couldn't fully be recovered. And when I began my study and training in functional medicine nutrition, I had an epiphany. I was able to finally explore and experience what that meant, what it meant to address my unique biology. And I could stop fearing what food would do to me, that's my tagline, and start embracing what it can do for me. And then clinically, you know, I was working with clients, mostly women, who were showing up in my office primarily for weight loss. And it was very important for me to introduce them to the concept that weight management, the need for weight management, is really the result of symptoms. You know, too much weight, too little weight is definitely a result of a body's imbalance and mind's imbalance. So here I was working with women who had experienced similar treatment protocols as I had, and I noticed there was a common missing link. They were not feeling empowered. In fact, they were feeling disempowered by their treatment experience, and that the biological piece was not being addressed. So the epiphany that I had was that physiology impacts psychology and psychology impacts physiology. And that's how I came to develop my signature framework. And that is the impetus and the inspiration behind how I live a recovered life every day.
Wow. And now you're helping other people to achieve what you have. Let's start with definitions and make sure we understand the subject fully. There's a difference between the words eating disorder and disordered eating. Could you talk to that for a minute and help us just generally understand the terrain that we're discussing today?
Of course. Symptoms of disordered eating are very similar to the symptoms of a full-blown clinically diagnosed eating disorder. So those behaviors would be food restriction, binge eating, in other words, overeating to the point of being uncomfortably full. There's purging, and that could be via self-induced vomiting or excessive exercise, use of diet pills, and the use of laxatives. Disordered eating disorders also include issues that are self-worth based, basing your self-worth on body shape and size. There's a disturbance in the way one experiences their body. A person who might even fall into a healthy weight range but continues to feel that they are overweight. A person who doesn't see what the world sees when she looks in the mirror. Excessive or rigid exercise routine and feeling guilty when you're not making it there. Of course, there's obsessive calorie counting, fear of certain food groups, anxiety, confusion, and fear about those certain foods or food groups. Basically, a very rigid approach to eating, only eating certain foods. There could be inflexible meal times, refusal to eat in restaurants or outside of one's home. So you've got all of these symptoms, behavioral and thought-induced based on a belief system. So what differentiates disordered eating basically from eating disorders is the severity of the symptoms, how extreme the symptoms are, how psychologically impactful they are. So it's the severity and the degree. But I will say that people who are struggling with disordered eating behaviors, disordered, dysfunctional thoughts about food in their body are pretty much setting themselves up for a full-blown clinically diagnosed eating disorder. I just need to say one thing also that's really important to recognize, that very often disordered eating could be simply a result of misinformation spurred on by misguided beliefs, right? What we're seeing on social media, what we're seeing on the news or on some TV show with a celebrity influencer or trainer telling you to eat this, don't eat that. But it can also occur as a result of chronic illness. Person suffering restricts food as a result of fearing what that food will do to them for reasons related to health, as opposed to a fear of weight gain or some other psychological root cause.
Okay, that makes sense. And part of this, you've talked about the psychology behind this a little bit, and food is supposed to be, ideally, a pleasurable experience. You know, eating a meal, either a delicious meal by yourself, if you just say having lunch at work, or having a full-blown traditional meal with your family, these are pleasurable life experiences, things that a healthy person with a healthy mind ought to be able to sit down and enjoy without a lot of these things you mentioned, excessive calorie counting, wondering what that food is going to do to them, the old, this is going to go right to my hips kind of concerns. And of course, there are foods that can cause us health problems. We all know this. And yet we live in a society where, you know, perfection is probably unattainable. We sometimes around here at Dairobi joke about the organic hippie garden that nobody has and can live out of. And so finding a way of eating where we can enjoy it as a pleasurable experience, that it supports our healthy lifestyle, and that we don't live with some of the guilt and shame and challenges, it's tricky, I imagine. And of course, you've been there. You have vast experience of your own as well as with many clients. That must seriously affect the lifestyle of people to not be able to just sit and eat and enjoy food the way that someone with a healthier mindset or without an eating disorder is able to do.
Yeah. Dave, what you're bringing up brings so many different thoughts to me, because one's relationship with food is rooted so deeply. What people need to understand is that our very first experience with being seen, heard, and nurtured has to do with food. We survived the birth process. We're brought into this freezing cold, brightly lit room most of the time. And then our first experience with being closely held, that oxytocin hormone kicks in, has to do with being fed by our mothers, right? Whether it's mother's milk or even being closely held by another caregiver with a bottle. And that memory is stored very deeply within us and within our minds in the limbic part of the brain. So now fast forward, we're growing up. And perhaps we're receiving messages that create a sense of danger. We don't feel safe. We don't feel safe in our bodies. We don't feel safe in our surroundings. But our memory of what it was like to be nurtured and nourished and held and seen has to do with food. It makes sense that people will turn to food as adults in an effort to self-soothe. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And so when food switches from becoming a means of fuel and a socially pleasurable experience, as in the traditional family meal, for example, and instead becomes a way of filling in some hole that really can't be filled in by food, that's when we get into trouble.
Yes. The other thing that's important to understand, right now, I'm directing these comments to the person who is struggling with their relationship with food. The last thing I need to imply is that everybody has a dysfunctional and distorted relationship with food. I'm speaking to the person who feels that their relationship with food is holding them hostage. I'm speaking to the person who feels once their relationship with food is improved, their life will improve. I'm speaking to the person who is just so darn confused about what to eat, that it's easier just to deny their hunger and not eat at all. I'm speaking to the person that comes home from a rough day and remembers what it feels like to feel bad, eat something, feel better. So I really want to make that clear. Eating disorders, disordered eating behaviors, are a language of their own. Very often, we have emotions, feelings that we have no control over, and we find them very hard to express. So behaviors show up in an effort to feed what we're really hungry for. You know, the person who reaches for creamy, smooth kinds of things, ice cream, say, when they're stressed, they're looking for comfort and some sweetness in their lives. The person who wants crunchy tells me, I need crunchy. I want popcorn. I want chips. That person is usually dealing with anger that they have trouble expressing. The person who looks to pizza and bagels wants to fill a void. So there's something really very specific about how we choose to feed what we're truly hungry for. When I was going through my own recovery, what I found so frustrating, being told what I needed to weigh, what I needed to think and feel, what I needed to eat. Nobody was asking me what I was really hungry for. In addition, nobody was looking at my unique biology, how my body was responding to the food that I needed to eat. So it's a very, very multifaceted issue, and that's why I've adopted a functional medicine approach to recovery, because it takes into account that every body is unique and everything matters. All systems of the body are connected, and that functional medicine, in theory, acknowledges that all healing starts in the gut, pays heed to the gut-brain connection. So think about the disruption to the gut microbiome as a result of these eating disordered eating behaviors. We're restricting, we're binging, we're purging. And now we know that the gut sends messages to the brain. The brain sends messages to the gut. Again, I'm going to repeat, physiology impacts psychology, psychology impacts physiology.
And some of these things, you know, the gut as a second brain, for example, have been kind of scoffed at by scientists and yet recently proven by science that this is actually a thing. This is not some kind of woo-woo thinking out there or Eastern type of chakra stuff, that the gut is a second brain and the way it interacts with the mind, this is actually now good, solid science.
Yes, it is. And it needs to be acknowledged. And that's why I feel that a functional approach, an integrative approach, while it's unconventional and it's not embraced, especially from the nutritional aspect by the conventional recovery community, it's a very, very important part of healing.
So how does it work? Someone comes to you and they've got a disorder and they're ready to address it and they want an expert like yourself. And so they come in and you've already given us some clues about some of the questions you were not asked. We can safely assume you do ask those questions. So take us through it. A person comes to you with a disorder, and how do you apply functional medicine to help them deal with the situation they're in?
It starts with story. We want to know, what are the antecedents? What has set this person up to be in this position? Genetics plays a huge role in eating disorders now. We know that 65 to 85% of people who present with eating disorders have some sort of genetic component. We know biology plays a huge role. Very often, people who are struggling with eating disordered behaviors have a disruption of their hunger and fullness hormones, the ghrelin and leptin. We take a full history. We really complete what I call, and what we call in functional medicine, a timeline. When did these symptoms start? What was going on in your life at the time? What was the psychology that was perhaps impacting the physiology? Everything as deep as, did you take a lot of antibiotics as a child? Were you born vaginally or through a C-section? Because we know now that all affects the microbiome. And why that is so important to know for the history is because we also know now that children who have history with digestive distress, GI issues, have a higher prevalence to develop an eating disorder than those that don't. That speaks to the gut-brain connection as well. And then I also spend a lot of time with my clients talking about their own story. What is the story that morphed out of their belief system? What was the story that they were told? What is the belief system that they're attached to? And what parts of that story, what parts of that belief system can we reframe as it relates to their behavior with food and their body? And this work is very bio-individual. It's very unique. Everybody's story is unique. But the one common denominator, the one missing link with everybody I work with is the disconnection that they have with their bodies. They don't invite their bodies into the conversation. They don't know how to say to their bodies, what is it that you really need? And that is missing across the board with every single person I see. All the thoughts are in the head. You know, it's all about, I should eat this. I shouldn't eat that. I should feel this. I shouldn't feel that. I feel fat. Well, you know what? Fat's not a feeling. Fat is an essential nutrient. So we spend a lot of time doing what I call clearing the clutter of inflammatory thoughts, the clutter of toxic thoughts. And then, of course, we look at nutrition and lifestyle habits. Where are they deficient in terms of nutrients? Where are they deficient in terms of sleep? Where are they deficient in terms of appropriate movement? Where are they deficient in terms of their relationships? Where are they deficient in terms of purpose? Or for some, it's spirituality. And then, based on all that information, after weeks and sometimes months of working together, we create a toolbox. A toolbox of strategies so that they can manage the triggers that they share with me, because everybody has different triggers, what triggers them to behave a certain way. And we develop a new toolbox of strategies and skills so that they can live a fully nourished life.
Yeah, so simply put, you have to be somewhat of a psychologist, a guru, and spiritual leader, a physical expert in functional medicine. You're touching on so many areas of the human condition. That's kind of crazy. I mean, I'm a certified health coach, and that one lane is plenty. If I stay in my lane, I got lots to do. You've got four different lanes going on that I've detected so far, and you got to help the person on all of them.
It's the most fulfilling work. For me, it's a soul-driven passion. And I bring a lot of my own healing experience to my clients every day. I meet them with empathy. I am here to serve, not to please. I hold them accountable. And I understand and feel the fear. Because what's important to remember is that eating disorders are not the problem. They start out, Dave, as a brilliant solution. They came to be at a time in their lives so that they could stay in the world they find themselves in. But what happens is eventually the eating disorder starts to take them away from the world, the one where there are limitless opportunities and possibilities. And my role, my purpose, is to help them step into a new world where they no longer need the eating disorder, where they could say to the eating disorder, thank you for your service. You're no longer needed.
And what does that path look like for people? I understand this is a tough thing. And when someone comes to you, we assume that they are at a point of enough motivation that they're ready to tackle the issue. And so they're coming to you with some motivation. They're ready to make changes. But how's the path to recovery? What does it look like for a lot of people?
The path to recovery is certainly not linear. There are lots of stops and starts. And unfortunately, the dropout rate is high. So from my point of view, there has to be a lot of patience, a ton of compassion and understanding, and always a willingness to start over and take someone back. Because in my experience, what I found is that the most well-intentioned person who is struggling with eating disorders is basically rooted in fear. You know, it's a mindset of scarcity. So recovery is elusive for many. And there are four blocks to recovery. The first one is all about worthiness. Understanding that we as human beings were born with a universally given right to feel that we are valued. And of course, we'd hope to value ourselves. The second block, and this is probably the biggest one, well, maybe the second biggest one, runs hand in hand with the fourth, is an inability and an unwillingness. And I don't use those words to imply that somebody doesn't have the right motivation or intention, but an unwillingness and an inability to sit through the discomfort that is going to come up for them during the recovery process. And the discomfort is going to be rooted in emotions, psychology, mental well-being, because I'm asking them to reframe what they believe to be true for themselves. And very often that could show up as feeling that they are betraying the people that gave them that message. I have to work in such a way to constantly instill compassion for the message, compassion for what was, so that there can be acceptance and ultimately forgiveness. And that can be very uncomfortable. It's also very uncomfortable to let go of an identity. You know, I can remember myself along these lines. For me, my eating disorder showed up as a restrictive eating disorder. I was severely underweight. And when I finally started to practice recovery, I was going out for dinner with friends and I ordered something that was completely out of character for me. And I remember my best girlfriend said to me, "You're eating that?" And of course, she didn't mean any harm, but I was mortified. I felt like I was being called out because it was so out of the realm of the image that I had projected. And that was very uncomfortable for me. So yeah, it would have been easier for me to say, oh, I ordered the wrong thing, or send it back and then just ordered the, you know, steamed fish and steamed broccoli that I was usually eating that I only ate half of. So that's very uncomfortable to give up that identity. And then speaking to the point that this eating disorder started out as a solution in an effort to self-soothe, the fear comes up, who will I be without it? How am I going to feel my feelings without it? So that's where the emotional psychological discomfort comes in. But there's physical discomfort too. You know, for the restrictive eater who now starts eating again, digestive system now has to wake up and get used to what's going on. That's uncomfortable. For the person who was binging, overeating, compulsively overeating, might start to feel very uncomfortable allowing herself to feel hunger. That's another block to recovery. And then there's mindset. Are you coming from a mindset of scarcity, which is rooted in fear, or can you embrace a mindset of abundance where you're living in what is, not what if? And sometimes it's all about gratitude, and sometimes it's just enough to be grateful for the fact that you want to be grateful. And if that's where you are today, that's fantastic. And then the fourth block is consistency. So you need to be consistent. You need to keep putting one foot in front of another. You start crawling and then you learn to walk and you're taking baby steps, and you have to be consistent before you can hit the ground running.
One of the things you mentioned in there made me think about those people surrounding someone with an eating disorder, which could be all of us. I mean, if you've got a large enough family or circle of friends, there's someone in your circle that may have an eating disorder, right? So as you told the story about your friend who I assume meant no harm, but it was harmful, it was hurtful to you. What advice do you have for people? And of course, we don't know who has an eating disorder. You can't just, it's not like there's a light bulb above their head that goes off when they're around food. You should be careful around me. I have an eating disorder. Like, we don't know. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. But what are the comments and things that we do and say that are really not helpful and that we should just be more careful of around anyone and everybody, just so that we are more sensitive to these issues?
The two things that come to mind, number one, it's not an eating disorder. It's not about the food. As I shared earlier, an eating disorder shows up as being about the food, but it's not about food. It's about expression. It's about a belief system. It's about worthiness. It's about self-soothing. So as a loved one or a friend who is observing disordered behaviors, it's very important to approach it from that perspective. Are you okay? Is this something you want to talk about? I would start there and understand again that the eating disorder is a means to survive. It's a means to get through feelings and situations that the person who's struggling deems intolerable or fears he or she can't handle.
Okay, one more question, and this probably just shows my own ignorance on the subject. I have this kind of preconceived notion in my head of eating disorders mostly affecting young women, but is that largely true? And along those lines, if it's something that starts with young women, and you talk about how many people drop out of the program, is it easier to overcome this as you grow older, or are there people that have a disorder for a very long time? So talk to us about the demographics of this. Who's most likely to have it? And I imagine in this day and age, if I am correct, that young women are more likely to have an eating disorder, I imagine that social media and some of the modern issues that we're seeing in our lives of connectivity and body issues and whatnot can only be having harmful effects. So I may be giving you too much there in one comment, but talk to us about that issue of who is the demographic, and then is it something that gets easier over time, or am I just completely wrong there in my assumptions?
No, your assumptions are clearly understandable. Sadly, and I say this truly with a heavy heart, I have been aware of children as young as 8 years old showing signs of an eating disorder. And I myself now am working with a woman who is 76 years old. So the scope is huge. eating disorders are very, very prevalent in women of midlife. And when you think about it, eating disorders basically happen during developmental periods in life. And as I said, they start out as a means to self-soothe. They start out as what the person perceives to be a solution. It's easier to think about food all the time. It's easier to concentrate on the parts of your body that you hate than it is to think about what's painful in your life. And of course, the root causes are going to be different. You know, an 8-year-old, an 11-year-old, a 13-year-old are not going to be impacted by life cycle changes that a midlife woman would. But along these lines, though, think about a woman in her 60s who lost a spouse, whether it be through divorce or death. And she's now facing life alone and is pretty damn scared. So that is a very big demographic within the eating disorder spectrum today. There really is a spectrum, Dave. The question is truthfully a difficult one for me to answer because, as I said, I've seen inquiries made to help children, and I know the range of women that I work with. My clientele ranges between mid to late 20s, as I just said, into the 70s. And everybody's coming with a different story. And it's just as difficult for everybody. It's just as difficult for everybody. Demons are demons, right? And belief systems that we hold on to. In fact, I think it might even be harder for the older woman to let go because it's so much a part of her identity. It's so much a part of her coping mechanism. And so deeply ingrained that she's afraid to let go of it.
Wow. Okay. And so what is one to do? So people listening, I assume, like many things, there comes a time in anyone's life when they're suddenly ready for a thing. I know for myself, there's plenty of good habits people have advised me over the years that I've just not been ready for, and I just don't do it until I'm just ready to do it. And I assume it's the same with people who come to you. I've alluded to this before. My assumption is that someone kind of hits a point that they're sick and tired of being sick and tired about whatever it is that's dysfunctional in their life. They're ready to make steps. And so what do they do next? They're ready to address their eating disorder. What do they do?
Find a practitioner that gets it. Find a practitioner that wants to partner with you, that is looking to empower you. What attracts me about the functional medicine approach, this unconventional approach that I've adopted and that I share with colleagues and clients alike, is about a therapeutic partnership. Recovery from anything is impossible unless you feel empowered. And to be told that in order to recover, you have to eat this, you have to behave a certain way, is anything but empowering. So I implore people who are struggling to find a practitioner that is going to guide you on your path according to your story, how you can reframe it, how you can turn the page on what's no longer working for you. So you have before you a blank page where you can basically write your happily ever after. And at the same time, address your unique biology. Because bottom line is, and this is a tenet of functional medicine nutrition, it's not so much about what you're eating. It's about what your body is doing with what you're eating. And from an eating psychology standpoint, it's not about what you're eating. It's about what's eating you.
Oh, wow. That's powerful. You've mentioned a couple times that your approach is unconventional. Will you please describe what you consider to be a conventional approach so that we can contrast the two?
Absolutely. A conventional approach, basically, like conventional medicine, and I love doctors. I believe that we all need medicine, and very often we need a conventional approach. The conventional approach for eating disorder recovery is basically about symptom management. So it's about weight restoration or weight loss, and it's about behavior management. And what's missing is that piece that I keep alluding to, the biological piece the what is your body doing with the food that you're eating. And the conventional approach fails, in my experience and my opinion, to look at the fact that the patient before you might not be able to break down and digest a bagel with cream cheese. And if she complains of digestive upset, she needs to look at that aspect, what her body is doing with the food, instead of being sent for a therapy session to discuss why she's so distressed about having to eat that. A functional medicine approach is going to look at the biology as well as the psychology. Not just symptom management, it's going to look at root cause. And very often, the root cause, as you know as a health coach, is rooted in biology and story.
And story comes from the mind. And I can't remember where I read this. You do have stuff on mind-body, which we weren't going to touch on today, but I'd like to just for a minute anyway, if you don't mind. I became a mindfulness practitioner and started a meditation practice about 5 years ago. And within the first 6 months, I was introduced to the body scan as a simple form of meditation where you spend time just lying or sitting and really get in touch with your body from top to bottom with, is there any pain? What does it feel like? What's the energy there? And going from every single point of your body, either from the top of your head to your toes or the other way around, depending on which guided meditation you're listening to, if you do one of these guided meditations. And it was fascinating to me because there was parts of my body I hadn't ever thought about ever. I'd never paid attention to my lower back or my stomach or my right lung or left lung, whatever, right? You get the idea. I was 45 years old and for the first time in my life, really kind of digging in and doing this very simple practice. And you mentioned this earlier about what is going on in the body, what's going on in the mind. You've talked about story, but speak about that for a minute because it seems to me from my experience and with myself that many of these things are things that I was never taught. I never really spent much time in introspection or being meditative or really trying to understand myself. We tend to live in a kind of go-getting society of, you know, get through school, get a job, get a career. And you know, often people get married and you're just kind of moving along this track that can be fairly fast-paced, lots going on, and very, very few people ever really stop and spend quality time in meditation or mindfulness. It sounds like this is part of what you're advising people to do, though, as well, correct?
No question. No question. You know, I always like to say, invite your body as an honored guest to the table with you. You know, always invite your body into the conversation. But mind-body nutrition, which is a big part of eating psychology, refers to how the thoughts impact our biology and how our thoughts impact our behaviors with food. Now, I like to think about emotions and thoughts. Emotions, we have no control over, but thoughts we do. So this is where we get to choose. And mindfulness allows us to look at our thoughts in such a way that we can feel our emotions, but put space between the two and make a determination about how we want to respond versus how we want to react. And when you take that to the table with you, it's about slowing down. It's about engaging all of your senses. Like you talk about a body scan. Well, we can make that metaphoric analogous to the eating experience. And, you know, you started off our talk just about that, the eating experience. But certainly, you know, slowing down when you pick up a fork full of food or a piece of chocolate or whatever it is and invite your nose into the experience. And then when you take a bite, fully chew it and feel how the texture changes and then feel it going down your throat. And if it helps really visualize the whole process of digestion and allow yourself to honor your hunger, allow yourself to honor when you're full, knowing that you can always come back for more. Give yourself permission to be in that experience. That's mind-body nutrition. And to that point, there's so much talk today about emotional eating. I take offense to that. I think that we all need to bring emotion to the table with us. It needs to be a joyous experience. It needs to be a loving experience. And you know what? Life isn't always full of positive emotion, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with feeling sad. We must feel sad. We must feel our anger. We must feel our disappointment. So I want you to bring emotion with you to the table because I want you to be. I want you to be instead of just doing. And that's the difference. We could talk about stress eating, eating when we're stressed, eating in an effort not to feel the stress. But don't ever eat in an effort not to feel emotion.
Okay, I love that. Well, I've kept you longer than I thought I would, but I think it's been important because you've had so many great tips. But I'm just wondering, before I let you go, if there's anything else you'd like to add to the conversation or say to my audience that you think is important and you've not been able to say yet.
What I always like to share is that recovery from anything, and what is the definition of recovery? To regain what was lost or taken. Recovery is relational. So one's relationship to self is reflected in one's relationship to everything else. That's something that's really important to remember. It starts with you. Second piece that I always like to share is that transformation, true transformation, is less about what we do to change and more about what we let go of in an effort to be the change that we want to see.
Wow, powerful. Well, this has been good. I have never really done an interview quite like this one. And I love the combination of skills that you bring to the table and your integrative approach. I think this has been exceptional. I hope there's people listening that can really benefit from this. And maybe even people who would like to reach out to you. And how would those people do that?
They can reach out to me via my website, which is thefreedompromise.com. And actually, I just recorded a video series, 10 really short, very inspirational videos that explain what I do, the difference between the conventional approach and the functional approach, and they can access that. I believe the link to that is thefreedompromise.com/video series.
Okay, excellent. Sounds like great resources. Thefreedompromise.com, correct?
Yes. And I have a Facebook group called The Freedom Promise Way. I'd love to have you join us. I have guest interviews all the time and constantly posting inspiration, and I love to engage with the members there. So that's The Freedom Promise Way on Facebook. Also, when you go to the website, you'll see I have a whole bunch of free guides and a masterclass and lots of goodies. So I'd love to hear from anybody who's looking for support or just has a question.
Well, thank you again. This has been Mindy Gorman-Plutzer, who's given us some phenomenal information. Whether we are struggling with some of these issues ourselves or we have a loved one who is, this is fantastic stuff. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Dave. Really enjoyed it.
I'm sure those listening have learned a lot, as I have. And to those of you listening, thank you so much for listening in on the Dairobi Health Show. This is Dave Sherwin, wishing you health and success. Thanks again so much for listening. Don't forget about all the free resources at Dairobi.com. Also, find the show notes for this episode by clicking on the podcast link on Dairobi.com. And if you want to pick out any of our world-class products while you're there, throw them in the shopping cart and use code INSIDER to save 15% off anything you like. See you next time.